Elena Petrovna von Hahn, more popularly known as Madame Blavatsky, or HPB, came from a noble family in Ukraine. Her father, Peter von Hahn, was a descendant of German nobility, while her mother, Helena Andreyevna Hahn, came from one of the oldest families of Russian nobility and was also a celebrated novelist. As a child, she would often have visions and displayed clairvoyance, as well as other metaphysical phenomena. Years later, she travelled throughout Europe and the Middle East, studying under various teachers and Sufi saints. She met her teacher, an Indian yogi named Master Moya, in London, who later directed her to go to New York in the United States. Once there, she founded a Theosophical Society. In 1885, she started to write The Secret Doctrine, which was finally published 3 years later in 1888. The Secret Doctrine has been acknowledged by many as one of the most remarkable books in the world. It is considered to be the Bible of Theosophy, a source book of the esoteric tradition that outlines the fundamental tenets of the secret doctrine of the past ages. Published as two volumes during her lifetime, The Cosmogenesis and Anthropogenesis, The Secret Doctrine explains the origin and evolution of the universe and of humanity through an account of root races dating back millions of years. Although the writer of The Secret Doctrine, Madame Blavatsky, often expressed that she was only the compiler of ancient wisdom that was passed on to her, the true authors of the work were her teachers, the Mahatmas, or great souls, who were the guardians of the secret wisdom of the ages. Prior to writing The Secret Doctrine, Madame Blavatsky wrote Isis Unveiled in two volumes. Today on Between Master and Disciples, we invite you to listen to excerpts from Isis Unveiled, volumes 1 and 2. In these excerpts, Madame Blavatsky discussed humankind's yearning for immortality, the concept of regeneration as explained by an Indian scripture, and the prohibition of meat-eating in different religions.
Man's yearning for immortality. Our human reason, the emanation of our finite mind, is certainly incapable of comprehending a divine intelligence, an endless and infinite entity, and, according to strict logic, that which transcends our understanding and would remain thoroughly incomprehensible to our senses cannot exist for us. Hence, it does not exist. So far, finite reason agrees with science and says there is no God. But on the other hand, our ego, that which lives and thinks and feels independently of us in our mortal casket, does more than believe. It knows that there exists a God in nature, for the sole and invincible artificer of all lives in us as we live in him. No dogmatic faith or exact science is able to uproot that intuitional feeling inherent in man when he has once fully realized it in himself.
Human nature is like universal nature in its abhorrence of a vacuum. It feels an intuitional yearning for a supreme power. Without a God, the cosmos would seem to it but like a soulless corpse. Mankind have one innate, irrepressible craving that must be satisfied in any religion. This is the yearning after the proofs of immortality. As Sir Thomas Browne has expressed it, "It is the heaviest stone that melancholy can throw at a man, to tell him that he is at the end of his nature, or that there is no future state to come, unto which this seems progressive, and otherwise made in vain." Is not the very existence of such a belief an evidence that thinking philosopher and unreasoning savage have both been compelled to acknowledge the testimony of their senses? That if, in isolated instances, spectral illusion may have resulted from physical causes, on the other hand, in thousands of instances, apparitions of persons have held converse with several individuals at once, who saw and heard them collectively, and could not all have been diseased in mind?
The greatest thinkers of Greece and Rome regarded such matters as demonstrated facts. They distinguished the apparitions by the names of manes, anima, and umbra. the Menes descending after the decease of the individual into the underworld, the Anima, or pure spirit, ascending to heaven, and the restless Umbra, or earthbound spirit, hovering about its tomb. Because the attraction of matter and love of its earthly body prevailed in it and prevented its ascension to higher regions. Terer legit canem tumulum circumvolet umbra ocas habet manes spiritus astra petit, says Ovid, speaking of the threefold constituents of souls. But all such definitions must be subjected to the careful analysis of philosophy. Too many of our thinkers do not consider that the numerous changes in language, the allegorical phraseology, and evident secretiveness of old mystic writers, who were generally under an obligation never to divulge the solemn secrets of the sanctuary, might have sadly misled translators and commentators.
The phrases of the medieval alchemist, they read literally, and even the veiled symbology of Plato is commonly misunderstood by the modern scholar. One day, they may learn to know better, and so become aware that the method of extreme necessarianism was practiced in ancient as well as in modern philosophy, that from the first ages of man, the fundamental truths of all that we are permitted to know on earth was in the safekeeping of the adepts of the sanctuary, that the difference in creeds and religious practice was only external, and that those guardians of the primitive divine revelation, who had solved every problem that is within the grasp of human intellect, were bound together by universal freemasonry of science and philosophy, which formed one unbroken chain around the globe. It is for philology and psychology to find the end of the thread. That done, it will then be ascertained that, by relaxing one single loop of the old religious systems, the chain of mystery may be disentangled.
The moment is more opportune than ever for the review of old philosophies. Archaeologists, philologists, astronomers, chemists, and physicists are getting nearer and nearer to the point where they will be forced to consider them. Physical science has already reached its limits of exploration. Dogmatic theology sees the springs of its inspiration dry. Unless we mistake the signs, the day is approaching when the world will receive the proofs that only ancient religions were in harmony with nature, and ancient science embraced all that can be known. Secrets long kept may be revealed, books long forgotten, and arts long time lost may be brought out to light again. Papyri and parchments of inestimable importance will turn up in the hands of men who pretend to have unrolled them from mummies, or stumbled upon them in buried crypts. Tablets and pillars whose sculptured revelations will stagger theologians and confound scientists may yet be excavated and interpreted. Who knows the possibilities of the future? An era of disenchantment and rebuilding will soon begin. Nay, has already begun. The cycle has almost run its course. A new one is about to begin. And the future pages of history may contain full evidence and convey full proof that, if ancestry can be in aught believed, descending spirits have conversed with man and told him secrets of the world unknown.
The meaning of regeneration explained in the Sutta Brahmana. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Jesus tells Nicodemus, that which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the spirit is spirit. This illusion, so unintelligible in itself, is explained in the Sutta Brahmana. It teaches that a man striving after spiritual perfection must have three births. First, physical from his mortal parents. Second, spiritual through religious sacrifice or initiation. Third, his final birth into the world of spirit, at death. Though it may seem strange that we should have to go to the old land of the Punjab and the banks of the sacred Ganges for an interpreter of words spoken in Jerusalem, and expounded on the banks of the Jordan, the fact is evident. This second birth, or regeneration of spirit, after the natural birth of that which is born of the flesh, might have astonished a Jewish ruler. Nevertheless, it had been taught 3,000 years before the appearance of the great Galilean prophet, not only in old India, but to all the epoptae, or seers of the pagan initiation, who were instructed in the great mysteries of life and death.
This secret of secrets, that soul is not knit to flesh, was practically demonstrated in the instance of the yogis, the followers of Kapila, one of the founders of the Sankhya school of philosophy. Having emancipated their souls from the fetters of Prakriti, the nature of the living thing that comes by birth, or Mahat, the physical perception of the senses and mind, in one sense creation, they so developed their soul, power and will force, as to have actually enabled themselves, while on earth, to communicate with the supernal worlds and perform what is termed miracles. Men whose astral spirits have attained on earth the Nariyasa, or the Mukti, liberation, are half-gods. Disembodied spirits, they reach moksha, or liberation of the soul from the cycle of birth and death, or nirvana, eternal bliss, and this is their second spiritual birth.
The sacrifice of blood interpreted. Buddha teaches the doctrine of a new birth as plainly as Jesus does. Desiring to break with the ancient mysteries, the Hindu reformer, though generally silent upon more than one secret dogma, clearly states his thought in several passages. Thus he says, "Some people are born again, evildoers go to hell, righteous people go to heaven, those who are free from all worldly desires enter nirvana, or eternal bliss." Elsewhere, Buddha states that it is better to believe in a future life in which happiness or misery can be felt, for if the heart believes therein, it will abandon sin and act virtuously. And even if there is no resurrection, such a life will bring a good name and the regard of men. But those who believe in extinction at death will not fail to commit any sin that they may choose, because of their disbelief in a future. Christ glorified not himself to be made high priest, but he that said unto him, "Thou art my son, today have I begotten thee."
This is a very clear inference that 1. Jesus was considered only in the light of a high priest like Melchizedek, another avatar, or incarnation of Christ, according to the fathers, and 2. That the writer thought that Jesus had become a son of God only at the moment of his initiation by water, hence that he was not born a god, neither was he begotten physically by him. Every initiate of the last hour became, by the very fact of his initiation, a son of God. When Maxime the Ephesian initiated the Emperor Julian into the Mithraic mysteries, he pronounced as the usual formula of the rite the following: "By this blood I wash thee from thy sins. The word of the Highest has entered unto thee, and his spirit henceforth will rest upon the newly born, the now begotten of the Highest God. Thou art the son of Mithra, thou art the son of God," repeated the disciples after Christ's baptism. When Paul shook off the viper into the fire without further injury to himself, the people of Miletus said that he was a god. "He is the son of God, the beautiful," was the term used by the disciples of Simon Magus, for they thought they recognized the great power of God in him.
A man can have no God that is not bounded by his own human conceptions. The wider the sweep of his spiritual vision, the mightier will be his deity. But where can we find a better demonstration of him than in man himself, in the spiritual and divine powers lying dormant in every human being? The very capacity to imagine the possibility of thaumaturgical powers is itself evidence that they exist, says the author of prophecy. The critic, as well as the skeptic, is generally inferior to the personal subject that he is reviewing, and therefore is hardly a competent witness. If there are counterfeits, somewhere there must have been a genuine original.
Blood begets phantoms, and its emanations furnish certain spirits with the materials required to fashion their temporary appearances. Blood, says Levy, is the first incarnation of the universal fluid. It is the materialized vital light. Its birth is the most marvelous of all nature's marvels. It lives only by perpetually transforming itself, for it is the universal Proteus. The blood issues from principles where there was none of it before, and it becomes flesh, bones, hair, nails, tears, and perspiration. It can be allied neither to corruption nor death. When life is gone, it begins decomposing. If you know how to reanimate it, to infuse into it life by a new magnetization of its globules, life will return to it again. The universal substance, with its double motion, is the great arcanum of being. Blood is the great arcanum of life. Blood, says the Hindu Ramatsariya, contains all the mysterious secrets of existence. No living being can exist without. It is profaning the great work of the Creator to eat blood or meat. In his turn, Moses, following the universal and traditional law, forbids eating blood or meat.
We thank you for your kind presence for today's episode of Between Master and Disciples. Now, please stay tuned to Supreme Master Television for Planet Earth, Our Loving Home. Coming up next, right after Noteworthy News. May Providence guide you in wisdom and love.
For more details, please visit www.suprememastertv.com/BMD